45-degree fly swatter at the top of the tower, reflecting that signal, deflecting the signal off to the horizon, and that system has a insertion loss of that transmission line up the tower that can actually have a half a decibel of gain. A transmission line with gain. Ain't that crazy? N2 moon bounce, K2RIW in the tech test.
There's also an efficiency problem with parabolic dishes. I think you lose, if you could do it, there's 3 dB to be gained from every parabolic dish. But I got to go into that later. I just remember that from my parabolic dish days.
Once again, Barry, I'm very glad you brought that up. You read any of the real good books, you'll find that a well-tuned parabolic dish, prime-fed, in other words, the feed horn's right in the front of the dish, typically has an aperture efficiency of around 60 to 65%. Aperture efficiency. That is not the efficiency you and I normally talk about. If I've got an inverting power supply, if I've got an RF amplifier, and I talk about its efficiency, I'm talking about DC efficiency versus RF signal out. If I was using a Class C 4CX250B tube type RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier, which on a good day runs 70% efficiency, that means you put 1,000 watts of DC power into that amplifier, 2,000 volts at half an ampere. You're putting 1,000 watts of raw DC power into that amplifier. On a good day, you will get 700 watts of CW power output at 70% efficiency. And the inefficiency in that case, the 300 watts, is burned up as heat in the anode of those tubes. And you're going to move 10 cubic feet of air per minute through those tubes to keep them cool, to keep them below 250 degrees Fahrenheit, so that you're not melting the seals, if you know what I mean. Real inefficiency. Now, when it comes to a parabolic dish, and you talk about 65% aperture efficiency, what does that mean? Let me drop. If I had a well-tuned parabolic dish in Far Rockaway, in your backyard, Barry, and I put 10 watts of RF power into that feed horn, and I radiate that signal straight up into the air, and I make a bunch of careful laboratory measurements of all the signal irradiated from that dish. You're putting 10 watts into it of RF energy at, say, 10 gigahertz, and you make some careful measurements all around that dish, and you'll find out that 9.95 watts is radiated into space. 99.5% radiation efficiency. Then what in the world is this 60% aperture efficiency? Well, that is a mathematical calculation based on an idealization. If you had the world's best feed horn, which you can't do, but if you had the world's best feed horn, that would smear the energy from the feed horn across the dish equally, uniform amplitude distribution. If every square inch or every square centimeter of that parabolic reflector received the exact same amount of power with no phase error, and if this magic feed horn then abruptly stopped the energy at the perimeter of the dish and there was no spillover, that dish, by definition, would have 100% aperture efficiency. That's the standard. Because your real, realizable feed horn, even a good Dick Turin, W2IMU, a microwave feed horn. Let me drop. So-called dual-mode feed horn, which is capable of giving you about 75% aperture efficiency. Even that horn still is going to have something like a 10 dB amplitude taper. In other words, the way the horn's primary pattern feeds the parabolic dish, it's going to create a hot spot in the center of the dish. More power goes to the center of the dish than the perimeter. The perimeter is lit up with 1/10 the amount of power per square inch. That's the 10 dB fall off of aperture distribution.
You also get spillover at the end of the dish, too.
Yeah, the majority of the inefficiency is due to amplitude taper. The last couple of percent of inefficiency is spillover. Some of the energy misses the edge of the dish and goes off into the dirt. So because your realizable feed horn has an amplitude distribution, a phase distribution, and spillover, that antenna will now have a gain that is 70% of the potential gain if it had uniform distribution. When you're talking about aperture distribution, aperture efficiency, you're talking about the decrease in potential gain for that size of parabolic dish. It is not any inefficiency that creates heat. It is not an inefficiency that lowers the signal amplitude. It is a gain decrease compared to an idealization. Now, in the case of a telescope, a good Newtonian telescope has a parabolic dish, and if you got a real good Newtonian telescope, properly manufactured, it can have what's called diffraction-limited performance. That means it really has an aperture efficiency of nearly 100%. How in the world can my parabolic antenna, a parabolic reflector on my telescope, do that where my 10 gigahertz dish cannot do that? And the answer is wavelengths. In the case of an 8-inch diameter parabolic mirror on a telescope operating at optical frequencies, it has roughly 1 million wavelengths of diameter of that reflector. When you've got a million wavelengths to play with, and your eyepiece, which is part of the optical system, which is the equivalent of the feed horn that's feeding that dish, that eyepiece has a diameter of 10,000 wavelengths. When you've got that many wavelengths to play with, you now can make uniform aperture distribution, and you can end up with an aperture efficiency that approaches 100%. They don't use those words, aperture efficiency. They use this other set of words, diffraction limited. It has something very similar to the same meaning. So, when you talk about aperture efficiency of a dish of 60%, it doesn't mean it's throwing away 40% of the power. It just means it has 40% less potential gain compared to what would be possible if the feed horn was perfect, but you can't buy or build that feed horn. So now that you realize that the loss in the dish is not loss, I can have two parabolic dishes, 3 feet in diameter, at 10 gigahertz. Let me drop.
Attention, ready for Houston.
I got two parabolic dishes in the backyard, 3 feet in diameter, aimed at each other. I'm putting a 1 watt signal into dish number one. 3 feet away, I'm picking up the signal out of the other dish. I'll pick up 0.9 watt. Even though each individual dish has an aperture efficiency of 60%, and there's two of them looking at each other, therefore you would think that I'm going to get 0.36% of overall efficiency, you would think by simple calculation, in that experiment, where they're very close to each other, aimed at each other carefully, I'll get 0.9 or even better. Because each one is perfectly collimated in the way the aperture distribution of one is feeding the aperture distribution of the other. So it's not real inefficiency. The fact that I can aim those two dishes at each other gives you some idea of the efficiency that a periscope antenna system can do. You see what we're getting at here, Barry? N2 moon bounce, K2RIW.
KC2, do I keep more questions on the rounds of waveguide?
Okay, let's turn it over to KC2. That's pretty good. I think I learned something here because I imagine that the efficiency was lower, so that's good. I think you're saying the efficiency is closer to 90%.
And I tend to exaggerate your question.
It's way above 90%, Barry. Remember what I first told you, that dish in your backyard where you put 10 watts into it, 9.95 watts will be radiated into space somewhere. That's 99.5% radiation efficiency. You got to be careful with that word, aperture efficiency. That's just gain that you realize versus potential gain. You and I are willing to use a little bit lower gain as the number we attack onto that dish, and if I want more gain, I increase its diameter. I mean, if the dish is capable of giving me 36 dB of gain and I'm getting 34 dB of gain, and I really want 36, I make it a little bit larger and use the exact same aperture efficiency, but I get the gain I want by just setting the right size. You don't have loss. The way you can prove that is you and I could put a kilowatt into that dish all day long, turn off the kilowatt, walk over there and touch everything, and if you've done a good job, everything will be ice cold. There is no loss. Yeah, your feed line going out there will have a little bit of loss. still have a little bit of heat in it, a couple of watts worth out of a kilowatt, but still the dish itself runs at very close to 100% efficiency. Now you know why periscope antenna systems, so-called fly swatter antenna systems, for a certain period of time were extremely popular, very high in performance. The only reason they're unpopular today is that for a period of time we were sharing the exact same frequency range terrestrially and space-wise, and these dishes on the ground aimed straight up in the air were feeding signals to the satellites by the spillover, if you know what I mean. And so the FCC set some rules on that. So for a period of time, periscope antenna systems fell out of favor. They're starting to fall back into favor. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. Just a couple of questions back on round waveguide again. First one that comes to mind is, I understand how the polarization, which when you're putting polarization into a waveguide, it's square, you know, it's rectangular in shape. So just due to the geometry of the waveguide, you can determine the polarity or the polarization of that wave as it goes down from what, you know, the input side of the waveguide to the end. And if the waveguide is twisted, you could actually, you know, spin it around if you wanted to. But when you get to the round waveguide, you're going to somehow, I guess, launch the signal into the round, and then it's going to come out on the other side. How would you mark that? And how would you know or verify that what the polarization is due to the lack of mechanical geometry of the pipe? That's question number one. And number two, what happens if the pipe bends, like you put elbows in it and other things? Does that really mess it up? Or I'd imagine so. Like, back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And another thing, Dick, is there a flexible version of that pipe that could be used?
Absolutely. Just like you've got a accordion-pleated rectangular waveguide, which is a flexible joint, you can do the exact same thing in round guide. In fact, the corrugations you've got on the outside of heliacs comes close to what we're talking about here, but you can make much finer gradations there. In the case of rectangular guide, Glenn, if I've got the guide laying flat on the table, broad wall against the table, everything going down that guide within the rated frequency region, say for instance WR90, and I'm using it between 8 and 12 gigs, everything going down that guide is purely vertically polarized. There's an E field from top to bottom, anywhere that you make a measurement in that guide, and there is very little E field from left to right. You've got to be careful how you make that measurement. You can be fooled by that one, but I'll go into that later. Purely vertically polarized, and there is absolutely no capability of that wave to rotate in polarization. The dimensions of the guide and the constraints of the wave, what is it called now, the boundary values is the words they usually use, no polarization rotation can take place. And when you make E-plane and H-plane elbows in rectangular guide, after the elbow and after the 45-degree bend and 90-degree bend and whatever, the polarization is thoroughly maintained with a slight catch. Let me drop. If you make careful measurements out of any place in the rectangular guide that has a perturbation, if you've done anything to interrupt the pure rectangular smooth guide, roll a BB down it, dent one of the walls, go through an E-plane elbow or an H-plane elbow or an accordion pleat or whatever, you go to any kind of a perturbation and you make a careful set of measurements. In the near field of the perturbation, you will find some other modes being launched. Even though I've launched the TE10 mode, I may, after the perturbation, be able to measure a small amount of TE20, TE01, and so on. Other waveguide modes, other methods of bouncing. However, in WR90, used at 8 to 12 gigahertz, every one of those higher modes are evanescent. They all die off at an extremely fast rate. You go 2 inches downrange from that perturbation, and those higher order modes have thoroughly been suppressed because the waveguide is waveguide beyond cutoff for those higher order modes. They all disappear very rapidly. But you could intentionally use bumps in the guide to generate higher order modes. That's exactly what the Decturin feed horn, the W2IMU dual mode feed horn does. It has a round piece of pipe launching the wave, and it makes a very sudden funnel perturbation at a 30-degree angle, it flares out from one diameter to a much larger diameter. That perturbation in the round guide is a shock excitation of a next higher order mode. The main mode that you're launching down the round guide is called TE11. By the way, the subscripts in round guide and the subscripts in rectangular guide look very different. It happens to be the exact same wave. It's just a different way of measuring it and a different way of setting up the subscripts. Therefore, people think that a TE11 mode going down a round guide and a TE10 mode going down a rectangular guide are two different modes. They're the absolutely identical mode. They're bouncing the exact same way, even though one case is round, the other case is rectangular. The exact same waveguide mode, just a different way of describing it. But once you get past that, the Dick Turin horn has got two different diameters to it. The round section that you launch the wave in, it's a pure TE11 round wave going down there. The 30-degree flare angle shock excites the next higher mode, TM11, I think it is, yes, TE11, and it shock excites the TM11. Now the larger diameter rest of the horn is propagating two modes at once, TE11 and TM11. If you have just the right amplitude between the two, if you have just the right length between the two so that the phases come out right, at the output throat, at the output mouth of that horn, all surface currents go to zero. The magic of that horn is it launches a wave where there is no RF current flowing in the sheet metal right at the mouth of the horn. The magic of that is it has no side lobes. It has no back lobes. It's got the purest pattern you've ever seen, and it gives you the highest possible efficiency for lighting up a parabolic dish for that diameter of horn. Beautiful invention. He's got a patent on that, and there's a beautiful article in the antennas.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If you Google the word Richard H. Turin, T-U-R-R-I-N, and dual mode horn, you'll find his patent, you'll find his article in Antennas and Propagation way back in 1967, I think it was. Was it Microwave Theory and Technique? No, it was Antennas and Propagation magazine. And very well designed. And with 3/4-inch hardware that you can get out of Home Depot, you can now find a pipe flange that adapts between 3/4-inch and 1.5-inch pipe. That is the 30-degree flare angle. And so you can construct that horn out of the components you can buy out of a Home Depot plumbing department. You can build an X-band version of that horn. So a good waveguide, a good microwave ham radio operator walking down the aisles of a hardware store can see all kinds of techniques of reusing that hardware at those microwave frequencies. I know I've gone a little bit off to one side of what you asked, Glenn, but I think that comes close to... wait a minute now. You asked what happens with the round waveguide when you go through a 45-degree elbow, 90-degree elbow. Without a doubt, you launch higher order modes, they die off in a hurry, but quite often you will set up other polarizations. You think you've launched pure vertical. You think you've launched pure vertical polarization, and you will see some other polarization. What a guy does with round waveguide, if he has the ability, is he puts metallic septums periodically in the guide. Very, very close to the place where he launched, he'll put a metallic septum. If it's a vertically polarized wave, he'll put a horizontal sheet of metal that's maybe an inch from front to back into the pipe, right across it, and that forces pure vertical polarization. It kills all the horizontal. You quite often, with round waveguide, make a launching horn by taking an end cap and putting a SMA connector into one side of it with a little bit of a quarter-inch long piece of wire on the inside as the launching probe. It really is a ground plane antenna, if you know what I mean. Inside of the end cap, you plug the end cap into the water pipe at the far end where you're receiving the signal. You rotate that in polarization until you see the peak in the valley. You're measuring the axial ratio, if it was circular polarized, or you're measuring the polarization. So you can easily find out what polarization your particular chunk of hardware is giving you. If you're unhappy with it, you put septums in the right place to force the polarization. So you've got control of that. You can also put the screws in the side. and inject the screws at just the right amount to force the polarization to be anything you want, to do impedance matching. You can get rid of standing wave ratio in round water pipe with screws. You can control the polarization and the standing wave ratio by using screws as a poor man's slug tuner. KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the deck net. You would really enjoy microwave, Glenn.
Enter Exchange with a comment.
Hey, Wesley, recognized. It is interesting. The septum, now I understand. Okay, because in other words, once I put a piece of metal inside, and basically partition a small section of the end of the of round pipe, and then when I put the small little antenna on the end of the SMA connector, okay, the termination, and then I could rotate between the septum and the end cap, and then they can definitely, basically just tune for the peak across that waveguide and then determine what that insertion loss is. Okay, no, very good, Dick. That makes it a lot more clear, because I was wondering, boy, when you're launching that thing, that would be really, really hard to determine how, what you did with the polarization when it came out on the other end. Very good, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
The polarization is easy to measure. The polarization is easy to correct with septums and screws and BBs and things like that, and bending the guide. There was a time when I needed to tune a piece of waveguide. I literally took a very large pair of channel lock pliers and crushed the round waveguide in just the right direction, just the right amount, in order to control the polarization and or impedance. I was building a filter at the time, and I wanted to change the cutoff frequency of the filter. It was a round filter, and I squeezed the pipe in just the right position. If you know what you're doing, you'd be amazed what simple techniques can be used here. Before I go over to Wesley, let me tell you that when you use 45-degree elbows and 90-degree elbows in 3/4-inch water pipe, common sense would lead you to believe that signal would really get lost going around those corners, the X-band signal. It doesn't. It goes down there beautifully. Your 45-degree elbow probably gives you a 1.1 vis-war. Your 90-degree elbow probably gives you a 1.3 vis-war. And if that bothers you, it's very easy to tune it out with screws. And the signal goes around that corner. And yes, the polarization, if it was a pure vertical signal going into a 90-degree elbow, and if the elbow is completely horizontal or completely vertical, the polarization would not be rotated. If the elbow was mounted at a 45-degree angle, 45 degrees to the left or the right of being purely vertical or purely horizontal, you would get some polarization rotation. That's predictable. That's called the chirality problem. By the same token, a purely horizontal signal bouncing off the floor gives you a purely horizontal signal. If the floor is tilted from left to right, a purely horizontal signal will come out with a different polarization. The floor has chirality in that case. So even flat surfaces can give you a different polarization after the bounce. You can prove that to yourself by taking a bathroom mirror, a hand mirror, lay it on the table, look at your wife.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Lay the mirror flat on the table, and your wife is sitting on the other side of the table, and you look at her reflection in the mirror, you will see her upside down. Hold the mirror far to your right, where the mirror is completely vertical, and look at her reflection. She'll be reversed left to right. Hold the mirror halfway between those two positions, down at a 45-degree angle, and now your wife, who is sitting across from you, is purely up and down, but the reflection in the mirror will have her laying down, if you know what I mean, sideways. Polarization got rotated. So even a pure flat surface at a oblique angle will give you polarization rotation. So do elbows in waveguide do that. But in many cases, the higher order modes that are launched are evanescent. They die off real fast. The polarization rotation is anticipatable and correctable with septums and tuning screws and other techniques. By the way, the septum you put into a round piece of pipe doesn't have to be flat. You can take what's going to be a septum that's going to be 2 inches long, and you can twist it at a 45-degree angle from input end to output end and mount that into the pipe. It will twist the polarization. The first guy who did that was a guy named Subramaniam Bose. He did it at 60 gigahertz, He did it in 1890. Ain't that crazy? Let me drop. The first guy who did serious waveguide and microwave experimentation with spark gap transmitters. Subramaniam Bose, a man from India, educated in London, made polarization rotating devices by putting pieces of tinfoil inside of the pages of the railway timetables, and by twisting that book, he made polarization rotate between the signal going in and the signal coming out of this of the railroad table with the pieces of tinfoil between the pages. And he was doing that at 60 gigahertz in 1890. You ask the average modern-day microwave engineer, when was 60 gigahertz first used seriously? They'll come up with numbers like 1960. That's 70 years too late. That guy was really ahead of his time. Wes had a question. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yes, first I would like to thank Glenn that he's present on the TechNet with you. I have enjoyed your discussion late hours after the TechNet when the repeater was off. Unfortunately, the repeater was on when you finished talking. And I would like you to proceed with that. But before that, I have a comment on what you just spoke about. Actually, I have proposed a subject that is quite right on the money. Before we do something, we have to visualize something. Most of the people think about the waves as a two-dimensional structure, so we write them on the paper. But if you want to know what is what magnetic field B looks like versus the electric field E and a pointing vector S, then I should describe that this way. I saw my mental pig a pair of vectors coming out of the same point on the wave. Hold your right hand flat in front of your face with your thumb stuck out on the side at the right angle in the shape of an L. Now rotate your hand until your fingers point in the direction of the electric field, and your palm faces in the direction of the magnetic field. If your hand is aligned properly, you should be able to fold your fingers so they point in the direction of the magnetic field. So we assume we don't move the thumb. This actually imitates the crossing of the electric field into the magnetic field. And the direction of the cross product is a pointing vector and is indicated by your thumb. If you're done with this activity correctly, your thumb should be pointed out of the screen towards your face. The orientation of the rest of your hand depends on whether you align your fingers with an electric field vector pointing left or right. One of them is easy on the hand, and the other makes you like trying to perform some odd form of yoga. But the reason that I am talking about it is visualization. For the moment, we're not going to stay on it long. Many people would like to know a simple question. Well, the electric fields are tridimensional and also magnetic fields, like spheres. How can they have a direction? The vectors on the sine wave, if they are spherical, and those pulling or repulsing from all around, is the electric field positive or negative? How can they be perpendicular to one another? And the magnetic field has both, but a question is, where are these poles? Are they located? When either an electric or magnetic field moves and creates the other, where is that location? So, for example, we're moving a magnetic field to create an electric field. Where is the electric field? Superimposed on the magnetic one or offset. I believe that will give people an idea about tri-dimensional structure of the magnetic or electromagnetic waves. Back to you, sir.
I'm going to repeat what you just said because it's pretty good. And I'm going to add slightly different words. I'm holding my hand in front of my face. My hand is, the plane of my hand is perpendicular to the ground. My fingers are aimed at the ceiling, and the thumb is aimed at my face. That's the way I'm holding my hand right now. Assuming my fingers represent the E-field direction, if I bend my fingers at a 90-degree angle, so instead of aiming at the ceiling, they're aimed at my left-hand wall. If my fingers in the first position aimed at the ceiling represent the E-field, if in the second position my fingers represent the H-field, the magnetic field, of a wave that I'm studying, now as I rotate my fingers from straight up to 90-degree bend of my fingers, so it's aimed at the left-hand wall, I am crossing E into H. I'm rotating like a right-handed screw thread. If I did that, the wave would represent a wave that is propagating toward my face, exactly as Wes said. My thumb would be the direction of that wave. So E cross H, straight up. In other words, from my point of view, the E field is at 12 o'clock. The H field is at 9 o'clock. When I bend my fingers from 12 o'clock toward 9 o'clock, I am rotating in the direction of a right-handed screw thread. That screw would be advancing in the direction that my thumb is pointing toward my face. That would be a wave propagating toward my face. Although it's very difficult, I can do the opposite. I can aim my finger away from my face, still have my fingers aimed at the ceiling. It's a difficult arm bend to do that. Now the E field is at 12 o'clock, and if the H field in this case is at 3 o'clock toward the right-hand wall, in that case,
cancel.
That particular wave would be propagating away from me. What's hard to believe is I can have both of those events occurring simultaneously. If that first wave with the thumb pointing toward my face was coming toward me, and right in front of my face is a sheet of metal, and the wave reflects off that sheet of metal, after it reflects off the sheet of metal, the wave would be identical to the second experiment where my thumb was away from my face. The E field is still vertical. The H field is now at the 3 o'clock position from my point of view. That wave is now propagating away from me. That is a standing wave in free space. Free space is a beautiful medium for propagating a standing wave. Free space is a kind of transmission line. I could call it that. Transmission medium. It completely keeps separate the signal that is flowing toward my face and the signal that's flowing away from my face. The medium, in general, does not mix them in any way. The signal flowing toward my face and the signal flowing away from my face, those two signals do not see each other. They don't mix in any way. If I put a ground plane antenna, I put my rubber duck antenna in front of my face for the first time. My rubber duck is picking up the signal that's flowing toward me. It's picking up the signal flowing away from me. It is a non-directional antenna. It is in that antenna mixing the two together, and now both of those signals will go into my handy-talkie, and as I move my handy-talkie further away from my face or closer to my face, I will find places where the signal is maximum and the signal is minimum, and I can measure the standing wave ratio created by that rubber duck in that particular propagating signal in free space. Maybe that helps. N2XJN, K2RIW at the TechNet.
Yeah, pretty good. That was much better than I was able to describe. We transfer both energy and momentum without transferring any mass. Can we do that? Yes. Yeah. That might seem obvious for mechanical waves, especially if you have been bowled over the strong ocean wave. But when the question would be, when the last time you ever felt pressed by the radio wave or knocked down by the beam of light, we just don't experience radiation pressure. Of course, there is still something that could be computed. If we could imagine a sine wave as a cycle as a circle moving in time. Let me drop. And we're starting from the left-hand side of the horizontal line. We have X and Y. And the time is delta T. And the time is horizontal line, which is a center of the circle. Now, we have a vector from the center of the circle to the edge of the circle. Now, the circle is turning around, and at the same time, the vector is turning around, and at the same time, a circle is moving in time. So we start from the left-hand side. There is nothing on the graph. We don't have a sine wave wave. Yes, we have 0 point. Why, when the vector is pointing from 9 o'clock going towards 12 o'clock and the circle is moving, we actually building a sine wave in two-dimensional pattern. So if we look at X and T, delta T, on the graph, but we're moving that circle through that delta T horizontal line, we're building a sine wave. When then the vector goes to the 12 o'clock, then we have a maximum of the amplitude. Then it goes to the 3 o'clock, we have a 0 point. Then it goes to 6 o'clock, we have the same maximum peak, but reversed in charge. So that would be the three-dimensional representation of the sine wave. But that is from the point of view of geometry. Now, if we try to look at that, from the point of view of the electrical properties, we should realize that B and E are 90 degrees. So if B is pointing at 12 o'clock, E is pointing, let's say, at 3 o'clock. But every half of a cycle, the polarization change, that means we're starting the sine wave where the vector, pointing vector S, is our X line. We have a B field vertically at 12 o'clock, and we have an E field at 3 o'clock. The next half of a cycle, we have a B field pointing at 6 o'clock and the E field pointing at 9 o'clock. And the next cycle starts. Then we have again the B field pointing at 12 o'clock and E field pointing at 3 o'clock. And again, we have in the next half of a cycle, we have a B field pointing at 6 o'clock and the E field pointing at 9 o'clock. That, I believe, would be a visualization of tri-dimensional structure of the wave. That gives us also ability to understand the phase shift as well and other properties. Back to you.
Yeah, one way of describing a sine wave is to make believe it is a point on the perimeter of a wheel. The wheel is rotating. That point on that perimeter is really moving in a circular manner. But if I only care about its vertical position and I throw away my understanding of its horizontal position, I only look at its vertical position, and I look at its vertical position on one complete rotation. Up and down in the time domain, it will generate a position versus time that is a sine wave. So a sine wave really is a circular device can generate the sine wave as long as you've got the right kind of sliding slots and whatever in the mechanical mechanism, or you decide to only study its vertical position and ignore its horizontal position. But the wheel itself, as the wheel rotates, the wheel is going through a 360-degree rotation, and there's a one-to-one relationship between the degrees of rotation of the wheel and what we call the degrees of phase of the sine wave. If I made my sine wave start off, if I had the spot on the wheel at the 9 o'clock position at the beginning of the experiment, and I'm going to rotate the wheel in a clockwise manner, before I rotate the wheel at all, the dot on the perimeter of the wheel is at the 9 o'clock position. That's the neutral position. I call that 0 volts, and I could call that 0 phase. As I rotate the wheel 90 degrees, the dot on the perimeter will move from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock. I've rotated 90 degrees. I've advanced 90 degrees in the wave that I'm generating, 90 degrees of phase.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
90 degrees of phase is where a sine wave goes from zero to maximum, and so on. So by looking at the rotation of a wheel and a dot on the perimeter of the wheel, a point that you're considering, you can figure out the one-to-one relationship between rotation, degrees of rotation, phase angle of the sine wave that you're generating. And so you can see how it's a very smooth curve that has lots of deflection, minimum accelerations. It doesn't ever come to a hard stop like a square wave, if you know what I mean. It gives the minimum acceleration really does something. By the way, when a wave propagates through a medium, let's say, for instance, we've got a wave propagating through the ocean, and without a doubt, that wave in the ocean, when it slams up against your piling because your house is located on the seashore, you know, you have no doubt in your mind that energy is being transferred by that wave into your pilings. The beach can become eroded, your piling can become loosened, real energy is being transferred. However, if you took a block of wood and put it in the ocean, and assume the wind is not blowing, and the wave goes by, and you study that block of wood, the wood is moving with the local water, you'll find out that primarily the block of wood is moving up and down. It does not translate per se. It moves in a slightly elliptical pattern. It moves a little bit forward and a little bit back, but the majority of the motion is up and down. Each individual molecule of water, when a whole lot of waves go by, all of those water molecules are in the exact same spot. Energy has been transferred, but mass has not been moved per se. In other words, a general mass movement of the ocean is not required for a wave to be propagated. And a radio wave in space has some of these properties. Now, the
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
You could say the wave in space has no mass. That's not absolutely clear. A solar sail is capturing electromagnetic energy, an electromagnetic wave radiated by the sun, and you can get thrust out of that. Now, when you use a solar sail, are you getting thrust out of the pushing action of the light itself, or is it of the particles from the coronal mass expulsion? There, it's not clear to me which one dominates. I mean, we've had a coronal mass expulsion that occurred a couple of days ago and threw a lot of material at the Earth at more than a million miles per hour. Real material got thrown into space and came and hit our atmosphere, caused some aurora, caused some electrical characteristics that you can measure. So real massive materials in solar wind was being propagated. Does a solar sail on a satellite use those particles of the solar wind, or is it really using light reflection? When you have that device that's got four blades inside of a glass bulb, it's called a radiometer, and the four blades are on a pivoting mechanism, and the four blades are black. Each blade is black on one side and silver on the other. Good common sense would lead you to believe, let me drop, that when the sunlight bounces off the silvered side, it's going to impart a lot more momentum than when the sunlight hits the blackened sides and gets absorbed. Therefore, good common sense would lead you to believe that when the sun shines on your radiometer, the blades are going to, on their pivot, rotate in the way that the silver sides move away from the incoming sunlight. Good common sense would lead you to believe that. you take a careful look at your radiometer the next time you get a chance. You'll find out it operates, it rotates in the other direction. The reason for that is the solar pressure of the light is an extremely small force. A much bigger force is the fact that the sunlight hitting the blackened side blades creates heating. The small number of air molecules that are inside that bulb get accelerated by the hot side and get pushed away, and that's what's really causing the rotation of the radiometer. The air molecules being heated and bounced off of the blackened side. The blackened sides of the paddles move away from the sunlight. So where is radiation pressure really coming from? Does a radio wave create a mass movement? I think the answer is almost no. Energy is being transferred, without a doubt. Is there real mass being transferred when a light wave or a radio wave is propagating through space? The answer might be yes, but I think it's an extremely small amount of mass that's being transferred. Maybe you've got a better feeling on this one, Wes and Glenn and others. WS2N. Here we go. N2XJN. K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. I don't want to stay long in this subject. I hope Limark will not switch off the repeater like they did last week and then switch on repeater when you guys done after 1.5 hour of without the repeater for some unknown to me reason. But yes, it was a good point. Let me drop. Since the power is energy on move, the notion of the power existing in a place does not make much sense. But instead, we should speak of the power delivered to a place. The boundary between one place and another is described by an area. What's the difference is between being inside the room and outside the room? The answer is what side of the doorway you are on. How is the opening described by this area? So the sensible definition of the power density is the power per area. If I remember correctly, there was a density equals P divided by A. And I have a question in this point to you. There is a number of words known as irradiance, radiant flux, emitted power, energy flux, or energy flux density. How would you picture that set of the words, which all of them say for the same factor? Enter here.
Yeah, the optical people have a large number of words to describe brightness, energy flow, and so on. The main beginning process, from my point of view, is watts per square meter. When it comes to power, flux, density, the words that I'm most familiar with in the radio world, if my isotropic antenna is in the middle of a spherical room, it's a little bit like having a light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. If I've chosen the diameter of the room or the radius of the room just right so that the total area of the room is 100 square meters, and if my light bulb in the middle of the room is really transmitting 100 watts of total amount of light in an isotropic manner, and the light coming off that bulb is hitting every square meter of the room equally, I've got 100 watts coming out of the light bulb, I've got 100 square meters for the total area of the inside of that room, therefore each square meter will have 1 watt. The power flux density coming off of that light bulb in my example would be 1 watt per square meter. The sun gives you an amount of energy in your backyard that's very close to 1300 watts per square meter. At high noon, you take a completely black surface, aim it toward the sun, and measure the amount of thermal energy picked up by that black surface, it will be very close to 1,300 watts per square meter. You and I know we are 93 million miles from the sun. We know, you could say we're in the middle of a spherical room,
that has a radius of 93 million miles. Make a brain experiment. Make believe that the Earth is located on the surface of a sphere which has a radius of 93 million miles. We know that each square meter of that sphere is getting 1,300 watts per square meter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
With some fairly simple geometry, you can calculate how many square meters there are in the total of this theoretical sphere that's 93 million miles of radius. Each individual square meter is getting 1,300 watts. You play that backwards, you know the exact power output of the sun, and it's roughly 10 to the 27 watts. The sun is producing 10 to the 27 watts, summer, winter, spring, fall, morning, noon, and night. 10 to the 27 watts is coming out of the sun. It's one hell of a transmitter. And there are all kinds of science fiction stories written on the assumption that at some time a very advanced society finishes building that sphere to gather all of that energy coming out of the sun at 93 million miles. You can make some great science fiction out of that, because your society is getting more and more progressive. It needs more and more energy, and eventually we want all of the energy the sun can produce. So we produce this this sphere at our radius that gathers all that energy. And I don't know quite sure what we're all going to do with it all. Maybe we're going to charge up some batteries good enough to go to the next star. You can see what I'm looking at here. So power flux density is the beginning of the process. Now, depending on whether or not your source of energy is a point source, that's what we've done in our example, the light bulb in the middle of the room, the isotropic antenna, you assume it's a point source. Let me drop. Any realistic light bulb really has some dimensions to it. Any realistic isotropic antenna has some dimensions to it. But if you're far enough away from it, you can assume it's a point source. And assuming that it's a point source, and you did the calculation just like I did, you can relate power flux density into total energy coming out at that frequency region. Now, if you've got a source that is distributed, say, for instance, I've got a room made out of luminescent material, and now there is an even distribution of light across that whole large wall of the room. If the room has a large enough wall compared to the distance I am from that wall, and now I measure watts per square meter, that's a crazy situation, which will have zero change. In other words, ordinarily when you've got a point source, it obeys the inverse square law. In that room that had 100 square meters of total area, and it was a 100-watt light bulb, and I'm getting 1 watt per square meter, if I suddenly double the radius of the room, so that now the room has twice the diameter or twice the radius, because the way a circle works with a square law, a room with twice the diameter will have 4 times the area. My room that used to have 100 square meters of area, because I doubled the diameter, it now has 400 square meters of area. But it's still collecting the exact same amount of light out of the light bulb. 400 square meters and 100 watts out of the light bulb means that each square meter gets a quarter of a watt. You see, now we have just, with geometry, demonstrated the inverse square law. I doubled the distance. I went from 1 watt per square meter from the light bulb on that room to 1 quarter of a watt per square meter. I got 1 quarter of the power when I doubled the range. It's an area relationship. And so,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WS2N.
Yeah, that is done pretty good. I actually think of a very, very good example of what you're saying right now.
Paul recognized. And Paul, you do or don't have a question, or should we discuss something about the space program? WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, no, I was just going to give you one quick report on the one of the rockets that are going to go up on the 22nd.
Okay, tell us about the rocket that's going on what date?
That would be on the 22nd. I've talked about it before, maybe about a month or so ago, so maybe 5 weeks ago. The New Star X-ray telescope is going to be launched from Kwajalein Island out in the Pacific on a Pegasus spacecraft. I might have spoken about it before. You might remember it. It was supposed to go up on the 14th, and it's going to go up on the 22nd now. A slight delay.
And repeat for us once again what New Star is going to do, Paul.
Okay, yeah. The New Star is a telescope in the hard X-ray portion of the spectrum. Chandra, you know, they call it the soft X-ray. And the same with another one called XMM. XMM was another one of these types of telescopes launched by the European Space Agency. I think it was about 1998, 1999 time frame. They usually go a couple of years. This one's going to be a two-year mission, and it's really going to look at black holes and try to figure out information about that. So in the beginning, it'll be pointing to the center of the Milky Way. It'll be looking at all the different relativistic jets that come out of these supermassive black holes at the center of the galaxy. And it'll do some gamma ray based, the gamma ray bursts that they have, things like that. They'll be looking at that. It'll be about 10 to 100 times better than Chandra or the XMM. It's one of these fields where the X-rays, let me drop it, where the X-rays are, slightly deflected. These mirrors are not really like a parabolic mirror. They're more like tubes. In fact, they call them conical. They're long tubes, and the X-rays come in so fast that they want to be able to bounce off of a parabolic mirror and then go into a focal point. So what they do is they just hit these things. They slightly make it like a glancing blow, and then they head back to the focal point. The interesting thing about this one is Chandra, for instance, has that similar setup, but it had no way of it didn't have any active focusing. Well, this thing does. So it'll be launched on a Pegasus rocket. I mean, it's going to be dropped from a big jet, put into a 600-kilometer equatorial orbit. So it should be interesting, Dick, the results they get from this. It's lightweight. Let me drop it. This is the one that I mentioned. It's going to open up. You've got the detectors on one side, and you've got the optics on the other side. And you've got this truss assembly, which will open up in space. Well, 10 meters, it's called 33 feet long. So it's a lightweight thing. Because of that system, it doesn't have to be a big, heavy thing. Like Chandra was launched by a space shuttle, I think, very heavy, maybe 20 times heavier than this thing. And this thing's going to be much more advanced, if you could believe that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, each of the things that we put in space that look at ultraviolet, soft X-rays, hard X-rays, we soon discover that every detector you put in space eventually becomes saturated by some event. In other words, Mother Nature will periodically make bursts of energy that are really huge and just goes to the top of the scale or whatever you're using to measure it. So this hard X-ray telescope is going to see things that we've never seen before, I am guessing. Also, what you're describing is a glancing blow mirror system, is what I call it. I think they're made in hyperbolic shapes. When you look at a storefront window at a grazing angle, at a very shallow angle, you realize that the glass is quite reflective. It's almost a mirror. Or on a hot summer day when you're driving your automobile across a road that stretches out in front of you for a long distance, and you're looking at the road at a grazing angle, you'll see a mirage. This is a little bit of heat waves above the road give you this mirage effect. So any kind of a very slightly reflecting surface at a grazing angle will give you reflection. An ordinary lens will let the X-rays just flow right through it, and the X-rays will just essentially ignore the lens. But if you make the lens as a whole bunch of concentric, almost cylindrical tubes, but they all have a very gentle shape to them, a hyperbolic shape, you get a focusing effect. And so these X-rays can be focused by this glancing technique. So this thing is going to be making images of hard X-rays. Is the telescope going to be mounted at a, when it finally gets on station, is it going to be at a Lagrange point or at a high altitude Earth orbit?